This is The Lazy Intellectual, audiobook recording of Then I Was Guided by Muhammad Al-Tijani Al-Samawi. Details, purchase, and access to a copy of the book have been listed in the description box. Please enjoy. Then I Was Guided by Muhammad Al-Tijani Al-Samawi. Chapter 2. The Pilgrimage to the House of Allah. I was 18 years of age when the Tunisian National Society of Scouts agreed to send me as one of the 6 Tunisian representatives to the first conference for Islamic and Arab Scouts, which took place in Mecca. I was the youngest member of the mission and clearly the least educated, for there were with me 2 headmasters, a teacher from the capital, a journalist, and a 5th whose job I did not know, although I later realized that he was a relative of the then Minister for Education. The journey was rather indirect. Our first stop was Athens, where we stayed for 2 days. Next was Amman, the capital of Jordan, in which we spent 4 days. And then we arrived in Saudi Arabia and participated in the conference and performed the rites of pilgrimage and Umrah. I cannot describe my feelings when I entered the house of Allah for the first time. My heart was beating so fast. I felt as if it was coming out of my chest to see the ancient house for itself. And the tears kept coming out of my eyes, endlessly. I imagined the angels carried me over the pilgrims and up to the roof of the Holy Kaaba, and answered the call of Allah from there. Allah, here I am. Your servant came to you to be at your service. Labbaik Allahumma labbaik. Listening to the other pilgrims, I gathered most of them had waited for a long time and saved up throughout their lives to come to Mecca. In my case, the journey was sudden and I was not prepared for it. I remember my father bidding me a tearful farewell when he saw the aeroplane ticket and knew for certain that I was going to perform the pilgrimage, saying, "Congratulations, my son. Allah has willed it that you should perform the pilgrimage before me at this age, for you are the son of Sidi Ahmed Al-Tijani. Pray for me at Allah's house to forgive me and grant me the pilgrimage to his house." I felt that Allah himself called me and cared for me and brought me to this place where everybody longs to visit, although some cannot make it. I appreciated this opportunity, therefore I threw myself into my prayers and tawaf, circling around the Kaaba. Even when drinking from the water of Zamzam and going up the mountains where people competed to get to Hara Cave in Al-Nur Mountain, I was only beaten by a young Sudanese pilgrim, so I was 2nd of 2. When I got there, I rolled myself on the floor as if I was rolling on the great prophet's lap and smelling his breath. What great memories! They left such a deep impression on me that I will never forget. Allah has cared for me in many ways, for I was liked by everybody I met in the conference, and many asked for my address in order to write to me in the future. As for my Tunisian companions, they looked down on me from the first meeting we had at the Tunisian capital when we were preparing for the journey. I sensed their feelings, but I was patient, for I knew that the people of the north looked down on the people from the south and considered them backwards. Soon enough, their view started to change. Throughout the journey and during the conference and the pilgrimage, I proved myself to be worthy of their respect due to my knowledge of poetry and my winning of many prizes. I went back to my country with more than 20 addresses from different nationalities. We stayed 25 days in Saudi Arabia, during which we met many learned Muslim scholars, ulama, and listened to their lectures. I was influenced by some of the beliefs of the Wahhabi sect and wished that all Muslims followed them. Indeed, I thought they were the chosen by Allah amongst all worshippers to guard his house, for they were the purest and most knowledgeable people on earth, and Allah had given them oil so that they could serve and could care for the pilgrims, guests of the merciful. When I came back from the pilgrimage to my country, I wore the Saudi national dress and was surprised by the reception that my father had prepared. Many people gathered at the station led by the sheikhs of the Isawiyah, Tijaniyah and the Qadiriyah Sufi order, complete with ceremonial drums. They took me through the streets of our town, chanting and cheering, and every time we passed a mosque, I was stopped for a short time whilst people, especially the old folk, came to congratulate me with tears in their eyes, longing to see the house of Allah and to visit the Prophet's grave. People looked at me as if they had not seen a young pilgrim, Hajj,
of my age in Gafsa before. I lived the happiest days of my life during that period, and many people, including the notables of the town, came to visit and congratulate me, and often asked me to read Al-Fatiha, the opening surah of the Quran, with the prayers in the presence of my father, from whom I was embarrassed, although he kept encouraging me. Every time a group of visitors left the house, my mother came to the sitting area to burn incense and read some amulets in order to rid me of bad spells. My father kept the celebration going for 3 nights in the center of the Tijani Sufi order. Each night, he slaughtered a sheep for a banquet. People asked me all sorts of questions, and my answers were mainly to praise the Saudis for their efforts to support and spread Islam. Soon, people started calling me Hajj, pilgrim, and whenever somebody shouted Hajj, it only meant me. Gradually, I became known amongst the various religious groups, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, and I went around the mosques lecturing on religious issues, telling people not to kiss the graves or touch the woods for blessings because these are signs of polytheism. My activity started to increase, and I was giving religious lessons on Fridays before the Imam's speech. I moved from Abi Yaqub Mosque to the Great Mosque because the Friday prayers were held in different times in those mosques, on midday in the former and during the afternoon in the latter. On Sundays, my lessons were mostly attended by my students at the secondary school where I taught technology. They liked me and appreciated my efforts because I gave them a lot of my time trying to help them in removing the clouds from their minds due to the teachings of the atheist and communist teachers of philosophy. And there were plenty of them. My students used to wait with eagerness for these religious circles, and some of them came to my house, for I had bought a number of Islamic books and read them thoroughly to bring myself up the standard of questions I used to be asked. During the year in which I did the pilgrimage to Mecca, I completed the other half of my religious duties by getting married. It was a wish of my mother to see me married before she passed away, for she had seen the weddings of all my half-brothers, and Allah gave her what she wished, and I got married to a young lady that I had never met before. My mother died after having been present at the birth of my first and second child, and she was preceded by my father, who had died 2 years before her. Prior to his death, he did the pilgrimage to Mecca, and 2 years later, before his death, he turned to Allah in repentance. The Libyan revolution succeeded during the period when the Arabs and the Muslims were feeling the humiliating defeat at the hands of the Israelis, and we saw that young revolutionary leader speaking on behalf of Islam and praying among his people, calling for the liberation of Al-Quds. I became attracted to his ideas, as did many young Muslims and Arabs, and as a result, we organized an educational visit to Libya by a group consisting of 40 men for the education department. We visited the country at the beginning of the revolution, and when we came back home, we were very optimistic and hopeful for a better future for Muslims and Arabs in the whole world. During the previous years, I had corresponded with some friends, and my friendships with a few of them became very close, so that they even asked me to visit them. Thus, I made all the preparations for a journey during the summer vacation, which lasted 3 months. I planned to go to Libya and Egypt by road, and from there, across the sea to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and then to Saudi Arabia. I meant to do Umrah there, and to renew my commitment to the Wahhabiyya, in whose fervour I campaigned amongst the students and in the mosques which were frequented by the Muslim Brotherhood. My reputation passed from my hometown to other neighbouring towns through visitors who might attend the Friday prayer and listen to the lessons, then go back to their communities. My reputation reached Sheikh Ismail al-Hadafi, leader of the Sufi order in Tuzla, capital of al-Jarid, and the birthplace of the famous poet Abu al-Qasim al-Shabi. This sheikh has many followers in Tunisia and abroad, especially among the working classes in France and Germany. I received an invitation from him through his agents in Gafsa, who wrote me a long letter thanking me for my services to Islam and the Muslims. In the letter, they claimed that the things I was doing would not bring me nearer to Allah because I had no learned sheikh. Quote, "He who has no sheikh, his sheikh will be a devil," unquote, and, quote, "You need a sheikh to show you the way, otherwise half of the knowledge is not completed," unquote. They informed me that the greatest of his age, Sheikh Ismail himself, had chosen me amongst all people to be on his closest private circle of followers. I was absolutely delighted when I heard the news. In fact, I cried in response to the divine care which had elevated me to the highest and best places, simply because I had been following the steps of Sidi al-Hadi al-Hafiyan, who was a Sufi sheikh known for his miracles, and I had become one of his closest followers. Also, I accompanied Sidi Sila Balsai and Sidi al-Jilani and other contemporary Sufi leaders, so I waited eagerly for that meeting. When I entered the sheikh's house, I looked curiously at the faces, and the place was full of followers, among whom were sheikhs wearing spotless white robes. After the greeting ceremony ended, Sheikh Ismail appeared, and everyone stood up and started kissing his hands with great respect. His deputy winked at me to tell me that this was the sheikh, but I did not show any enthusiasm, for I was waiting for something different from what I saw. I had drawn an imaginary picture of him in my mind, in accordance with what his agents and followers had told me about his miracles, and all I saw was an ordinary man without dignity or reverence. During the meeting, I was introduced to him by his deputy, and the sheikh received me warmly and sat me to his right and gave me some food. After dinner, the ritual ceremony started, and the deputy introduced me again to take the oath from the sheikh, and everybody congratulated me and blessed me. Later on, I understood from what the men were saying that I was known to them, which encouraged me to disagree with some of the answers given by the sheikh to the questions from the audience. Such behaviour led some of the men to express their disgust and to consider it bad manners in the presence of the sheikh, who is usually left unchallenged. The sheikh sensed the uneasy atmosphere and tried to cool the situation by using his wit. So he said, "He whose start is burning, his end will be shining." The audience took that as a graceful sign from the sheikh, which would guarantee my shining end, and congratulated me for that. However, the sheikh was clever and very experienced, so he did not let me continue with my irritable incursion, and told us the following story. One day, a learned man attended a class held by a pious man, and the pious man asked the learned man to go and get washed. So the learned man went and washed himself, then returned to the class. The pious man repeated his demand, "Go and get washed." The learned man went and washed himself again, thinking that he had not done it right the first time. When he came back to the class, the pious man asked him to wash again. The learned man started crying and said, "Master, I have washed myself from my work and knowledge, and I have nothing left except which Allah has granted me through your hands." At that moment, the pious man said, "Now you can sit down." I realized that I was the one whom the sheikh referred to in the story, and everyone else realized that as well, for they rebuked me when the sheikh left us to have a rest. They asked me to be silent and to show respect for the sheikh, lest I fail in my work, basing their arguments on the Quranic verse, "O you who believe, do not raise your voices above the voice of the Prophet, and do not speak loud to him as you speak to one another, lest your deeds become null while you do not perceive." Holy Quran, 49, verse 2. I then recognized my limits, so I complied and obeyed the orders, and the sheikh kept me near him, and subsequently I stayed with him for 3 days, during which I asked him many questions, some of them to test his knowledge. The sheikh knew that, and used to answer me by saying that there are two meanings for the Quran, one revealed and another hidden to a seventh degree. He opened his private safe for me and showed me a personal document which contained the names of pious and learned people connecting him with Imam Ali via many people such as Abu al-Hasan al-Shadili. It is worth noting here that these meetings held by the sheikh are spiritual ones and usually start with the sheikh reciting and chanting some verses from the Quran. After that, he reads a few poetic verses followed by chants and dhikrs by the men. And these chants are mainly centered around asceticism, piety, and the renunciation of this life and the eagerness to seek the life hereafter. After having finished with this part, the first man on the right-hand side of the sheikh reads what he can from the Quran. And when he says, "And Allah said that truthfully," the sheikh reads the beginning of another piece of poetry, and the whole congregation recites it after him, each person then reading a Quranic verse. Shortly after that, the men start leaning gently to the left and to the right, moving with the rhythms of the chants until the sheikh stands up, and with him the congregation, forming a circle with him at the centre. Next they start chanting, "Ah, ah, ah, ah," and the sheikh turns around in the center, then goes to each one of them, and shortly after the tempo heats up and the men start jumping up and down, shouting in an organized but irritating rhythm. After some hard work, quietness gradually prevails, and the sheikh reads his last piece of poetic verse, and then everybody comes to kiss the sheikh's head and shoulders until they finally sit down. I have shared with those people in their rituals, but not convincingly, for they contradict my own beliefs of not attributing any associates to Allah, i.e. not to request anything but from Allah. I fell on the floor crying and my mind scattered between two contradictory ideas, one being the Sufi ideology, in which a man goes through a spiritual experience based on the feelings of fear, on asceticism, and on trying to approach Allah through the saints and the learned men. The second idea was the Wahhabi, which taught me that all of that was an attempt to attribute associates to Allah, and that Allah will never forgive them. If the great Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi cannot help, nor could he intercede, then what is the value of the saints and pious people who came after him? In spite of the new position given to me by the Sheikh, for he appointed me as his deputy in Gafsa, I was not totally convinced, although I sometimes sympathized with the Sufi orders and felt that I should continue to respect them for the sake of those saints and God-fearing people. I often argued, basing my arguments on the Quranic verse, "And call not with Allah any other God. There is no God but He." Holy Quran 28, verse 88. And if somebody said to me that Allah said, "O you who believe, be careful of your duty to Allah and seek means of nearness to Him." Holy Quran 5, verse 35. I answered him quickly, in the way that the Saudi ulama had taught me, by saying, "The way to seek Allah is by doing a good deed." In any case, my mind was rather confused and troubled during that period, but from time to time, some followers came to my house where we celebrated Al-Imara, a type of dhikr. Our neighbours felt uneasy about the noises which we produced, but could not confront me. Therefore, they complained to my wife, via their wives, and when I learnt about the problem, I asked the followers to celebrate dhikr elsewhere. I excused myself by informing them that I was going abroad for 3 months, so I said farewell to my family and friends and sought my God, depending on Him and not believing in any other God but Him.